Hello, Justin.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
Doing great. Welcome to the DMZ.
I know that
you've been on Blogging Heads many times, but first time on the DMZ. So for those who don't know you, tell us a little bit about you.
Absolutely. I am Justin Green. I am a former intern of yours, Matt, at the Daily Caller. I now edit and contribute to a blog at the Daily Beast. My boss is David Frum.
Excellent. And for those who are interested in that transition and your sort of career and going from interning here at the Daily Caller to editing David Frum and blogging at the Daily Beast, check out, you were on my podcast, the Matt Lewis and the News podcast, about a month ago, and we hashed that out. So check that out. But I want to talk to you about some more timely stuff. And first, I'll be self-indulgent and talk about my latest post at The Week, which is about the upcoming Nerd Prom and the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I argue, Justin, that the geeks have inherited the earth, and it's true in many, many facets of life, but especially noticeable in journalism, where the people who run D.C. were once probably the same people on the receiving end of wedgies. But I know you had some differences on the piece. I'd love to hear them.
Well, I sort of think that people who run D.C., people who gravitate toward covering politics rather than directly being involved in politics, probably always were on the receiving end of wedgies. Sort of personality that makes you want to like dig through a political report or to go find a hidden nugget of information that people might be interested in, or to wait outside a congressman's office for hours just to get a couple questions in for a potential story. Those are the kind of people who I think have probably long been nerds. I haven't been here in D.C. long enough to be able to verify that anecdotally, but from the personality,
it seems like
that makes sense.
Well, it's like the difference between people who become baseball players and people who write about baseball and dig through, you know, the statistical analysis of baseball.
Right. Well, and something to note about that, though, is that I personally think that people who never played baseball or who played it only a little but who really love the game are far better writers about the game, because they appreciate it from the perspective of a viewer as compared to from watching the game, from having played the game itself. It's perhaps so different that it's so stripped away of some of the inside stories that people can actually make sense of it, and I think it's far more helpful.
So it sounds like you agree with me then that D.C. is a power city, and at least in terms of the journalist side, the people who are focused, you know, sort of celebrated. And see, I see this as an analogy to high school, right? Like at your high school prom, the prom king is you know, the football player. But the nerd prom, as it's affectionately called, really celebrate this is nerds' opportunity to rule the school, and I think that there is this proliferation of people, and this got cut out of my piece because it's controversial. so of course I'm going to talk about it here, but there is somewhere on the Asperger's spectrum some of these folks fall, and some of them have talked about this, have written about it, have blogged about it. I'm a huge fan of Dr. Sheldon Cooper and the Big Bang Theory. And, of course, you know, it's about a group of physicists in Southern California. But, frankly, I think the show could have just as easily been about a group of bloggers living in DuPont Circle.
Perhaps. So the perspective I have of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which I think probably deserves more mockery than anything else, is that the star of the show, even though he'll get made fun of some, is still the president, who kind of earned the wrath of nerd culture for his. I mean, you mentioned the Jedi mind meld comment, which a lot of my friends in journalism were, I don't know if they were upset at him or just dismayed that he so badly mangled a reference to Star Wars and Star Trek.
Right.
But
the unpardonable sin, I think.
Right. So, but like, despite the fact that it is, in fact, that you can call it a nerd prom, the star of the show is still someone who is very clearly not a nerd.
Well, I don't know. There's the cool side of Obama, And then there is a sort of Urkel side to Obama. Have you seen that picture of him riding that bike? So, and he's wonky. I mean, he is kind of wonky. And I mean, they're different types of nerds. So I think that he is sort of a wonky president, clearly.
That's probably true. By a similar sense, Bill Clinton's kind of a wonky president, too.
I think
you might call him a nerdier guy because he doesn't really seem to have been terribly athletic either.
Well, I think it's all subjective. I think that Bill Clinton certainly was a wonk and certainly was smart, but I think he had more of a jock persona, whether or not he was athletic.
I mean, do you remember that picture of him and Al Gore and their little walking, perhaps the most disgusting picture that I've ever seen? Clinton and Gore, and they're covered in sweat and these shorts that have surely been banned since the 90s, but oh.
Well, fair enough. I encourage everyone to read it and sound off in the comments. But I believe my argument is that the geeks have inherited the earth, that we once mocked nerds and they now run the world, and politics is merely one example. We could go into Bill Gates and all sorts of things. But let's move on to some maybe more pressing issues, or at least substantive issues. And let's talk about immigration. You know, Senator Rubio has been sort of taking the lead in trying to sell immigration reform, what some people call shamnesty, to conservatives. And it seems to me that this week was a turning point. That I don't want to say a turning point, and I don't want to say that it's like I don't want to say that it's game over, but it does seem to me that this week was the week when a lot of conservatives sort of turned against him. Is this overwrought, Justin?
I don't think so. Well, this week he lost to Rand Paul, didn't he?
Well, he had an excuse, and Eric Erickson also had, you know, people are legitimate or not. I mean, Rand Paul blamed Boston as, you know, it's prudent to now step back and look at security measures. So, but yeah, it's not a good thing if you're Rubio.
Yeah, I'm not personally a big fan of trying to make much out of Boston. We have no matter how you really look at it, one of the two was an American citizen, and they came and the younger one came here as a 9-year-old boy. So I'm not terribly sure there's much we could do in a system other than just banning people from certain regions, or from saying that if you have young boys in your family they can't come here, or a host of incredibly unpalatable things that I'm not sure that we really ought to consider as perhaps immigration policy. It has been sort of, I don't know if you want to say amusing or sad to watch what people have been calling the conservative civil war, to see the people who term immigration as shamnesty, or say that, or used the, I think Breitbart used the Marco phones thing, or publishing the emails of people who are typically your political allies, or your, at least your ideological allies. It's been kind of bizarre to see the way it's unfolded, or of Rubio saying that, or Rubio's camp suggesting that the opponents of immigration reform are similar to those who would have been in favor of slavery. And there's been some nasty splintering here, and I don't think it's good for the conservative movement or for the Republican Party.
I talked with in the run up to this. I, you know, had in the past years actually, I've had, you know, meetings with different Rubio folks, and they always said that they expected this to get nasty, but I doubt they expected that it would be. I assume that they underestimated how extreme the pushback would be. This issue is so divisive, and I think that, first of all, let me just preface it by saying I believe that there are entirely legitimate concerns with the bill. Anytime you have an 844 or whatever page bill, there are going to be things in there that are problematic. We're going to talk about one of those here in a minute, the Obamacare thing. But there's going to be amendments, and it's going to have to be hashed out. So I don't want to get into the weeds too much, but there certainly are legitimate concerns and criticisms of of the bill. Having said that, I do think that there's something scary about immigration for a lot of people. And I think that it's an emotional thing, because no matter what your problem is in life or what you're afraid of, you could blame immigrants for it. I mean, if you can't find a job, you could say that it's because of immigration. If you're afraid of crime, you might be led to believe. You know, there's so many. It's a very easy issue to demagogue and to fearmonger, in my opinion. And it doesn't mean that all the fears are unfounded. I mean, but I do think that it's the kind of thing where if people are on the fence, leaning toward immigration reform, it's kind of a pushover to scare them back off the fence.
Perhaps I think I share your general feelings about the bill itself. It's a big bill and it tries to accomplish a lot of things. There are obviously going to be some things in it that we think are good, some that are less so. We will have to work with that. I think it was a big mistake for, I suppose, watching some of Rubio's office's responses to these attacks and looking through some of the language. It looks like much of the language originated with Schumer's office, not Rubio's, which I find problematic. It's one of those where I'm not sure why Rubio attached himself to immigration. I'm not going to – psychoanalysis is not my thing. I don't think I'd be terribly good at it. But for whatever reason, he's put himself in a very awkward situation, and one that's going to be – have massive potential fallout for his political career.
If Rubio – I think this is a profiling courage for him, because I believe that he thinks this is the right thing to do. But – if his goal was to be president, this is not the advice he would have given him. I would have said, give great speeches, but don't do anything. Don't do anything controversial. Certainly not anything that could possibly scare the base off. Let someone else, you know, the pioneers take the arrows, right? Let somebody else propose things, and if it's popular with the base, then support it. And as soon as people turn against it, you start sniping at it. I mean, but if you look at the way Barack Obama managed to become president, it certainly wasn't by – he was a senator, and it certainly wasn't by pushing – authoring landmark legislation or accomplishing anything in the Senate. So I think that, you know, Rubio, I believe, is doing something for all the right reasons, and he believes it's the right thing to do. But it's certainly not the political advice you would have given him. You would have said, give good speeches, but don't do anything, don't make any waves. Be for what's going to happen, kind of thing. Do what's popular.
Yeah. Should we go into the weeds a little bit?
Well, yeah, I think that anytime you have a bill this big, right, so there's always like unintended consequences, and a very interesting one popped up last night. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. So I think the first person I saw reporting this was Jed Graham at Independent Business Daily, which is basically that the bill says that employers won't be required – in the simplest language, it's that people who have provisional status, who are allowed to stay in this country but are not citizens, who are on that sort of 10 to 13-year path, won't be – given access to the benefits of Obamacare. In other words, employers also won't have to provide them with Obamacare benefits. And Jed calculated this is about a $3,000 a year difference for employers. And that makes it basically a subsidy for employers not to hire citizens, to instead hire people who will be here legally working, who won't be violating any laws. But what it sets up is a strong incentive for employers not to hire citizens, instead to hire provisional workers.
Right, and here's something that the Rubio forces put in. You know, they certainly pushed immigration reform to the right compared to what it might have been, what it has been in the past, and they insisted on that people who are legal but not yet citizens would not be eligible for Obamacare, which sounds like something conservatives should love, but it's sort of like a Rubik's Cube. You know, you move one thing and then something else gets out of balance. And by doing that, they've now created the situation where employers would be incentivized to hire people in that provisional status as opposed to American citizens. it's something that they can work out, that they'll have to find a way to work out. But
I'm not so sure they can. So the sort of problem is that if conservatives now decide that they need to push the requiring everyone to be covered by Obamacare, basically stripping out that subsidy, that's going to be seen, I think, from the very far right as an endorsement or at least an acceptance of Obamacare. So I'm not sure where you – I think the problem now is that any move that fixes this, that makes it better policy, that prevents us from creating a two-tiered employment labor force, anything that tries to make it better is going to probably lose votes rather than gain them. So,
well, that I agree. I think that that it's a huge political problem. And aside from being
– Well, isn't every problem political?
Well, but aside from being a substantive political problem, it also is hurtful because it also reinforces the notion – these guys don't know what they're doing. These guys don't know what's in the bill. The bill's too big. There's all sorts of consequences that we're going to discover. You know, you have to pass the bill so we know what's in it, kind of thing. So this is very damaging, or potentially very damaging, to the cause. And by the way, I wrote about this at the Daily Caller this morning. Politico is interestingly writing sort of a series of posts warning conservatives against supporting immigration reform. I don't know if you've seen this, Justin.
Well, broadly speaking, it's correct. There's a piece we'll be publishing later this morning, which the basic thrust of it is that the very primary concern, above all else for conservatives, above the economic growth, above how we deal with political answers, is simply are new arrivals, are they assimilating, are they quickly reaching the achievement status of native-borns, of other recent arrivals? Are we managing to assimilate our citizens as we historically have? And that the problem seems to be with the most recent arrivals, who are predominantly Hispanic, is the answer is no. And it's not simply a first- or second-generational problem. It also reaches into the third generations and beyond, because after you have your initial assimilation, after we deal with the problems of learning English, of starting to get some educational attainment, you hit the problem of they become Americans. They're stricken by the problem which hits Americans in our own life, which is the breakdown of the family. And a broken down family is far more likely to rely on the government for things that ordinarily would be provided for by a family. And how do you think people who increasingly rely on the government are going to vote?
Right. That's a legitimate problem, a legitimate concern. I would say a few things. One, before I forget, Mickey Kalsa and I just debated this on my podcast, so check that out. And obviously, everybody knows Mickey from Blogging Heads here anyway, but we talked about it on the podcast, Matt Lewis Show podcast. I think that a few things about those concerns. One would be sort of substantively, I'm skeptical of the notion that that these concerns are unique or original to Hispanic immigrants. When we look back at what was said about, say, immigrants from Eastern Europe, for example, many of the same concerns and skepticism was voiced by Americans at the time. And we saw that over time they did assimilate and, in fact, become more likely. You know, Reagan won, you know, the Italian vote, the Irish vote, the Catholic vote, what used to be called the ethnic vote. You know, maybe Hispanics are different. I'm more skeptical of that than others.
What I would say is that I would try to look at it not as a what the ethnic group is, as what the time is instead. Most of the groups that you described earlier arrived from the late 18th or in the early 19th centuries, a time when we had most simply put, when it was very easy for someone to arrive here reasonably poor and with low levels of educational attainment, and through hard work and through forming a family and through doing all the right things to become at least moderately successful in life, and perhaps to become quite successful. And it was relatively easy for your family to assimilate. It was relatively easily for the second generation to do even better than the first. I don't think most people would disagree that those basic problems, those are things that we face now today that are not as easy as they were 100 years ago. They're not as easy as they were 50 years ago. And realistically, they're not as easy as they were 30 years ago. So the question is less about like who is coming here than what country are they coming to. And the country they're coming to is one that is more stagnant, one that has a bigger government, in which we have a real problem with the American dream. That's the way I would try to frame this debate. I'm not sure it's about whether they're Italian or whether they're Eastern European or whether they're Hispanic. I think it's more about the country in which they're arriving.
That's an interesting point. I would say I think that Rubio's rhetoric about immigration and the American dream is pertinent and ought to be a message that Republicans champion, and especially when it comes to attempts to do outreach to immigrants. Mm-hmm. Let me just say, though, on putting aside substance and policy and what's right, and as you know, I've written for years about why conservatives ought to embrace more Hispanic immigrants from a policy or substantive standpoint. But there is a political point, too. I mean, the concern is obviously that all these immigrants are going to vote Democratic. And I would argue the question is, do you want to take a short-term hit now or do you want to take a long-term hit in the future? I have the sense that the world is changing, that America is changing, and that there are going to be more and more Hispanics in America, and that it's vital for the Republican Party from a political standpoint, putting aside all the salutary benefits that I believe would come anyway, but solely from a political standpoint, that it's vital that the Republican Party not be branded as a xenophobic, know-nothing party. And if they fight this, or if they kill immigration reform and it goes down, you know, in flames, and the perception is that Republicans will have caused it, my concern is that, yes, in the short term, might be fine for Republicans, but they're sowing their seed to the seeds of long-term extinction.
And perhaps my view on this is that parties come and go, and that I'm not terribly, I think, as are you, that I'm not terribly tied to the Republican Party, that I mostly want to see the broad conservative principles win over time, and that if that comes with the Republican Party, that's great, but if that means that a new party has to be created to do that, sort of a so be it question. The way I want to approach this is to consider that realistically we've already had the great wave of Hispanic, mostly Mexican immigration. That's probably done. Mexico has an economy that's growing very nicely, a society that's aging, that's becoming more broadly prosperous. Once they figure out this drug war, they'll be in a position where we're not going to see much more net migration from Mexico, and the future waves are going to come from highly populated, dynamic countries in Africa, highly populated countries in Southern Asia, for instance, for Pakistan, Nigeria, Ghana. That's where the future waves are going to come from. It's one I'm heartened that they have E-Verify. I wish they pushed E-Verify up considerably faster. I think giving that 7 to 10 year window is far too long. And I know personally what I would do is I would find a way to become a provisional immigrant, get here. Say, and I don't really care about the citizenship part. Let's just, if I can get that, if I can get a green card, we're good. That's the way I kind of look at it. And I don't think it's a know-nothing perspective to continue to have a conservative party that demands that we have some broad right to determine who can legally come here, who can legally work here, and who is eligible to become an American citizen. So it's kind of it's going to be a big question for conservatives, and I'm not sure how we're going to figure that out.
No, it's a very difficult one. You mentioned Asians, and I think that's a prime example of the branding problem, which is to say that Asians, you know, a lot of people would argue ought to be conservative, and yet they voted against they voted for Obama. And I suspect that has to do with the branding problem that the Republican Party has perceived, rightly or wrongly, perceived as an anti-immigrant party. And so people are willing to vote against their values and in fact, their own economic self-interest in some cases in order to, because the Republican Party is just unacceptable.
Well, I'm not so sure. I think a small piece of me thinks that what we saw in the last two elections was not a mirage, but probably a one-hit wonder, and that Obama managed to assemble an electoral coalition unlike any we've ever seen. Piece together the young ethnic minorities and women. And if you look at those type of voters, if you look at young women, for instance, young women who are single and independent, there are going to be ways in which they're going to like some government services. And there's ways in which young people in general are going to say, why are we spending six or seven times as much on elderly people as we do on our young? And that's the question that that Obama has taken up and that has been a fairly forceful advocate for. I think most of his proposed solutions are quite wrong. The problem is that there is no Republican there seems to be a complete vacuum of Republican ideas in that field.
Well,
so by default, he's won.
Right. But the thing is, I agree with you that he has put together an interesting coalition. And I also agree with you that he may be unique. I mean, could Joe Biden have pulled off what Obama did? I mean, he's a charismatic figure. But here's the irony. The one person that I believe could do that on the right is Marco Rubio, whom we are now in the process of destroying.
Well, we will. I think we'll see what happens on immigration. I will end my immigration rant by simply saying that I'm glad that they gave it quite a bit of time to be read and debated before it goes to the floor. I think if absolutely nothing else, in the last 3 years, we've managed to get rid of earmarks, which were which were polluting the legislative process, and we've managed to force after the Obamacare debacle. Us to allow bills to be read and vigorously debated in public before they ever reach the floor of Congress. So that's a very good thing. So I will give kudos for that if I'm not as much of a fan of the bill itself.
All right. Well, you mentioned a few minutes ago when we were talking about immigration, about immigrants coming to America, not assimilating, not having an opportunity that they once had to rise up, the American dream. And it's a pretty good tie-in, I think, to what I want to talk about in terms of the Boston bombing story. Obviously, we've had now a week to digest what happened, and we've learned a little bit. We still obviously don't know everything, but we've learned a little bit. And I was hesitant to opine too much or speculate too much in the immediate days, and certainly hours and even days following the bombing, but I think now we've had enough time, and one thing, there seems to be this narrative fight taking place between those people who want to pretend that radical Islam had nothing to do with the bombing, and those people who want to, like, pretty much solely blame radical Islam. And I am somewhere in the middle. I think that there's no doubt that they were, like, inspired by this radical ideology and theology to do this horrific terrorist act. But I think you could ask, why were they susceptible? Now, clearly they were Chechen, but so was their uncle who called them losers. Why were they susceptible? And there have been some interesting things written. There's a guy named Tom Rogan, who is a colleague of mine at The Week, who wrote some interesting things about the alienation. And you should read him at Tom Rogan Thinks. And there was a really interesting piece at the Daily Beast, a guy named Christopher Dickey, who wrote this piece. And he comes up with the different arguments for why they were susceptible. And he says, first, testosterone. Almost all of the people who carry out terrorist attacks are young men. And I think that's true. I think that it's true not only because of testosterone, but because young people have this sort of, they're susceptible to romantic, quixotic notions, delusions of grandeur. The prefrontal cortex hasn't fully developed. I mean, I think that we underestimate this. But what say you, Justin? You're a young man, and well, you have not, as far as I know, done anything horrific.
Sure. Totally, I'm going to totally agree with the uncle that they were, in fact, losers.
Yeah, I think the bigger
mystery is the younger brother, who, I don't know, we're going to find out more, but who, from initial reports, his classmates talked about how he was a kind of a casual stoner, a feel-good guy. I mean, clearly these people had an incorrect impression of him, but he seemed to have far better assimilated into society than his older brother, who, as we saw, couldn't get citizenship because he hit his girlfriend and then blamed I think the way it was that the, his family blamed American culture for thinking that it was not okay to hit a woman. So that was a little bit of an assimilation problem.
Well, the older brother had a wife who was supporting him.
Right. Well, he had a wife and a daughter.
80 hours a week or something.
Well, and also their family was receiving welfare benefits in the state of Massachusetts. So it was a I suppose that's not a great way to treat it. I am kind of confused. So part of the reason I think the younger men are more susceptible to or just are more likely to do terrible things like this is that they don't – is it the is the alienation factor, is that they don't have a lot of attachments that would convince them that what they're doing is a terrible idea. The guy has a wife and kid and got him and then went off and killed people and ended up dead, abandoning his family essentially. So that's one of the –
yeah,
well, the profile things where you normally would say, like, oh, well, I mean, he's a suicide – he basically was a suicide terrorist. He was an idiot. But I don't know.
I think Western society in America specifically doesn't ask much of people. We don't summon people to do – to make sacrifices. We basically say this won't be that hard. With the exception of the vast minority of young people who go off to fight our wars, we're not asked to sacrifice much. And I believe that there is a yearning that young people generally have. You know, there's this stereotype that young people are apathetic, and I think that's true to a certain degree. But I also think that there's this yearning to be asked to do something big for glory. And I think young people are susceptible to that, and that can be channeled in positive ways or horrifically evil ways. There's a great book called Dedication and Leadership by a guy named Douglas Hyde that I've quoted a few times. He was a communist who became a Catholic, and he wrote this book to teach Catholics how to be more effective, because he believed that the communists were going to win, you know, sort of like Whitaker Chambers. He was leaving the winning side for the losing side, and he believed the communists were better sort of organizationally, because they inspired young people and gave and called them to do big things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something afoot here with sort of young people who are they're angry, they feel. And I mean, I can remember being young and being vulnerable, and obviously the vast majority of young people never become terrorists. I don't want to give that impression. But I think that there is something, again, the common denominator, aside from religion, seems to be young men. And in fact, in spite of religion, the common denominator of terrorists seem to be young men. I mean, there are exceptions, but that seems to be, if you were going to profile them, that you would look at young men. I once dated this girl, and her dad told me, and it was a little bit scary, actually, but he told me that if it were up to him, he would incarcerate men from the age of 15 to 25, because that's when 99% of the crimes take place. I'm like, okay, good to see you. We're going to go out now.
Yeah, nice to meet you. I will never speak with you again.
Yes, but there's truth to that. There is.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, young men are, we're a impetuous, violent bunch, and that's kind of embedded in us. That's the natural response. This is the age this is the age when men were historically asked to be soldiers and hard laborers and to do things that are no longer expected of them. So
yes, and. There's this book, I think it's called Wild at Heart, about, you know, what Christians, it's about why men have been like feminized and become docile, and that we have this urge to go out and do big things, and instead we're here blogging. But I think it's not just the sort of physicality of it. It's also that young men are susceptible, and you mentioned military, and I think there's a reason why, even in America, why when we draft people, you know, we don't just want 18-year-olds because they're in better physical shape, although that's part of it. We also want 18-year-olds because they will be more likely to kill if we tell them to, because they haven't experienced this life to the degree that someone 35 might have second thoughts about that.
That's probably fair. I'll give you that. I will have to, partly because I'm not yet sure. Never had the experience of that, so hopefully never, you know, never will. Never will.
Well, the interesting thing, but the one brother was not 18, right? The older brother was in his mid-20s and, as you said, was married. So that's young, but that's not, you know, young.
Right. So that he, as I mentioned, I think he's. I'm not sure what we're gonna learn from either one of them. It'll be interesting to see how things unfold. It'll be interesting to see how much information his brother ultimately gives up on his older brother, and we'll never know if that's accurate, if that's correct. But I was hoping that we could perhaps talk a little bit about how about one of your favorite topics about. Was how we historically view the Gipper.
Oh yeah, let's do it.
How different strains of conservatism attempt to, I suppose, to pull the legacy of the most popular Republican of the last half century, and how we attempt to, say like, this is the correct theological interpretation of what the great Reagan once said.
And we frequently talk about Reagan here in the DMZ, and it is interesting because everybody calls themselves a Reaganaut, right? So you could be Pat Buchanan or Marco Rubio, and you would still probably look to Reagan. And yet, obviously, what Reagan represents means different things to different people at this point. He belongs to the ages.
Well, he belongs to the 80s, is what I would... is perhaps look at it, which politics.
I like that.
Politics generally reflect the challenges of the year in which they take place. At least you would hope, I guess. And like for instance, this morning Bob Patterson, who used to work in the White House. He's one of the compassionate conservatives, I suppose. If you want to throw him a label, wrote a thing, suggesting that the GOP makes a big mistake by suggesting that Reagan was an avowed libertarian, that he disdained government, that he was a huge free trader. And I think it's an intriguing suggestion because we really face a little problem, which is that we have a middle class that is stagnating. I'm not sure I would call it disintegrating, but which is in one way or the other a middle and working class that is in trouble. Areas that used to be core Republican constituencies that are perhaps that need more government help, or that need a government help in a different way than it's being provided now, and Republicans aren't quite sure how to advance that. And that hits us when we're talking about entitlement reform. That hits us in what we view the government's role in education and basic research. That hits us in how we look at infrastructure spending, even. And so the next decade or two, I think we're going to have to fight this out again. I imagine we've probably fought it out before, but it's going to have to be round two or round three of what would Reagan do in the 21st century.
Right. Well, it's hard to judge Reagan. It's a complex thing. I mean, on one hand, you could say, on one hand, Reagan, his hero was FDR. He was a member of a union. And some of his rhetoric, he was very good at using rhetoric that was inclusive and communitarian, and you could be like an FDR New Deal Democrat and also support Reagan. And in fact, there were the Reagan Democrats. So on one hand, you could argue, of course, what you're saying is true. On the other hand, I think you could make an argument that Reagan, that we're standing on the shoulders of Reagan, and he, because he was so much closer to the New Deal and to the Great Society, he could only get away with being so conservative. That if Reagan lived today, having built on the accomplishments of the Reagan administration, he could push America even further to the right, to be even freer, to embrace free markets even more. So, it's unclear to me which of those two visions is correct, and I suspect that it's very complicated.
So I would leave it with the who wins question then. Republicans won the majority of the presidential elections between FDR and George Bush, and that we've lost the majority since. And that the Republican Party that maybe not had its peace with the New Deal, but the Republican Party that seemed to sort of before. I mean, Reagan raised, for instance, payroll taxes to make the Social Security work again. A smart move. He basically put the program back on track for the next 50 years. Good. Seemed to be pretty popular. And the Republican Party appealed to a lot of working class and middle class constituencies who wanted things that are quite different than now, who were more concerned, say, about law and order than we are today, and more concerned about genuinely high taxes than we are today. I think historically we have pretty good taxes compared to, say, what the taxes were in 1980. You know, you wrote a big piece this summer on how Reagan dramatically reduced the tax burden on most Americans. Good. But we'll keep fighting this out, I'd say.
Right. But he also raised taxes 11 times, as the other side would point out, even though he dramatically reduced the income tax rate, which I argue is incredibly important. But I do want to say that I read that Daily Beast piece, and I found it very interesting. It was posted, under your blog at the Daily Beast. But I do want to say, I think he pulled off an interesting sleight of hand. Maybe unintentionally. But he creates this paradigm where Reagan, comes at the end of Republican hegemony, where essentially Republicans dominated electorally from Ford, Nixon, Reagan, that Republicans from the 50s till the 80s won a lot of presidential elections. And I think that's true technically, but I think it's misleading. Because what happened was, I would argue that there was the era of FDR, which essentially lasted until Reagan. So yes, Republicans like Nixon and Eisenhower won presidential elections, but it didn't matter that much in the sense that they were still living in the world that FDR created. They were either managing the welfare state that he created or the New Deal. They really weren't rolling back anything. And we know that Nixon, created the EPA and all sorts of things, liberal, bureaucracies. And then Reagan came in, and I would argue that he started the era of Reagan, which I think has just ended. It ended when Barack Obama was elected, but it included Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton had 8 years. But it was still, he was living in the era of Reagan. So Clinton had to say the era of big government is over, things like that. So I think that it's misleading to argue that Republicans, or conservatism was, winning in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And Republicans winning presidential elections isn't the point. It's about what ideology is the dominant force in our society. And so I think that that's a misleading point in that column.
The big question, the one that we can always argue the historical details, but the big question is, what form of government are Americans going to prefer going into the future? And it seems that Reagan lost. So pull back to, I guess, the 30,000 feet view, the way that Eric Erickson likes to go once in a while. The reason Reagan was so broadly successful and is remembered by so many for so many good things today is that in the 1970s it was possible. The government regulated bridges, airports, the government. I mean, the government regulated the way we would move foodstuffs around. It was a far more structured, government-centric life than it is today.
Right.
And Reagan peeled those things back. And that was one of the reasons he was so broadly successful, was because he dramatically reduced the government's involvement in people's lives. But what we're seeing now is a pushback against that. So I think the big question that we have is we try to build a political structure for the next 20, 30, 40 years, for the next few generations in this 21st century. Is it going to look more like what FDR wanted, or is it going to look more like what we had in the Reagan, Clinton, Bush years?
Well,
that's the big one. That's how we find out who won.
That's a big question, and it's probably a good place for us to stop. But first, give us some plugs. How can people keep up with you?
I tweet probably too much.
I think you may, actually.
So I've heard. I'm pretty prolific. I tweet at jgreendc. Like I said, I write for the Daily Beast. We write a lot, too. It's fun, and I occasionally appear on Blogging Heads. It's a fun thing.
Excellent. Well, Justin, thank you for filling in for Bill, who is on assignment. And
It was fun to have an all-Republican DMZ. I think it's what the viewers really deserve.
This is what they've been clamoring for.
That's right.
The DMZ. So thank you for doing it, and until next time, folks, we have you covered here inside the...